from WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Talk about deregulation. Newly ensconced President Donald Trump said this week he wants to do away with maybe 75% of federal regulation, maybe more. What would that look like? We'll ask. Plus, we'll look this hour at President Trump's pipeline moves and restrictions on who can say what in the federal government. This hour On Point. In our 100-day spotlight, pipelines, no-talk rules, and Donald Trump's way with regulation. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How do you see the Trump approach for the environment, safety, the economy? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We start today with new White House limits on public communications from federal agencies like the EPA, the Agriculture and Interior Departments. Juliet Alperin joins me from Washington, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Juliet, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Great to be with you, Tom.
So what exactly has been ordered first on what you and others are calling the media blackout?
Well, it really depends on which agency you're talking about, but what certainly has emerged is a theme, which is several agencies that deal with science and the environment are the ones who are facing restrictions at this point that have been put in writing. So, for example, if you talk about the Environmental Protection Agency, they have a very strict policy that's been put in effect, which essentially prohibits any public-facing communication, whether that's through social media, news releases, interviews with reporters, all of that is now centralized and restricted. With the Interior Department, they have a limit on both kind of what's been happening with some of their social media accounts as well as, again, conversations not as much with reporters but with outside groups, whether those are tribes, state governments, environmental groups, industry groups, and so forth. And then if you talk about the Agriculture Department, they've been having a bit of a back and forth. They imposed both restrictions agency-wide in terms of communications on a range of issues, as well as their scientific research arm had restrictions that were imposed on it by the acting head of that program. And some of those have been now just been lifted Wednesday in response to the negative publicity they were getting.
Juliet, how are these measures like and or unlike measures taken by previous administrations in the early days of coming to power?
That's a great question. So in some ways, they are similar in that every incoming administration, and this was true with President Obama, with President George W. Bush, and so forth, comes in and tries to start speaking with one voice. And so that is something that we have seen in previous administrations, that there's often a pause in kind of, you know, formal press releases and policy announcements because they want to kind of all get on the same page. What is different here are two different aspects. One is that it seems to be, I would say three. One is that these restrictions seem to be the most severe in agencies that deal with science and the environment. Two, with the advances in technology and social media, you know, Twitter's 10 years old, and so this wasn't a problem back, you know, even when the last president took power. But now you have kind of a much more decentralized form of communication with the public, and so we're seeing mechanisms that are happening there that they're kind of trying to grab hold of multiple different things. It's not just the question of a formal press release. And then I think more broadly, you're seeing really kind of an interesting pushback from career employees who have seen this before and are now being more active and more visible in pushing back against some of these restrictions.
What's the nature or message in that pushback, Juliet?
What we're seeing is really, whether it's some former employees or some current employees, that they're making it very clear that they're not going to go quietly, that they don't want these restrictions, and they feel that there's a prospect that if they have information, factual information, that does not comport with the new president's agenda, that they're going to be impeded from communicating that to the public, and they are trying to figure out ways to resist it.
What you mentioned with the EPA, or we've read about a freeze on grants and contracts, and it sounds subtle, but what does that mean? Is that some marginal operation there? What's the significance of that?
No, that's absolutely, and thank you for mentioning that. So what we've seen there is that, again, there was, and this is, again, appears to be unique to EPA, that that the political appointees in that agency said that first they did an immediate halt of all grants and contracts and said no new grants and contracts can go out. And now they're, again, they seem to be revising it. They now say they're reviewing it. They're going to allow the awarding of some environmental program grants and state revolving funds to states and tribes. These are crucial. These are things that do things like clean up the water in Flint, that help, help tribes deal with contamination that they have, on reservations. So, again, there was a real alarm, and now they say they're looking to review all categories of grants, but it does show both that they're real, that there are real issues at stake here, and that people are very sensitive to the idea that certain issues are being targeted under this new administration.
And finally, Juliet, this gets into an interpretive area, maybe, but why would the environment and issues of science be the particular target of a clampdown by this administration?
Well, what I would say, and obviously we have to be careful about how we interpret this, particularly because we've gotten limited comments from the White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer, who says that they're looking into this. There is no question that there's a significant clash between what President Trump has said he wants to do on climate and the environment, and both what the previous administration was pursuing and what is supported by many of the men and women who work in this agency. So there's no question that there is a conflict in positions here. And so on one hand, there's an effort by the incoming administration to impose its policy agenda, as every administration has the right to do, but also kind of a heightened sensitivity on the part of the men and women working in these agencies that they want to stick to the facts and they feel that there's public information on these issues that needs to get out.
Juliet, listeners are focused very closely on this. May we take one call while we've got you on the air?
Sure.
Julie in Austin, Texas. You're on with Juliet Eilprin of The Washington Post. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say I'm having a hard time with understanding how, he can get away with all of this in the first 4 days. Gag orders on the EPA, on USDA, defunding things. How can this happen, and how much action is this really going? How many, what's going to happen from here?
Juliet, let us pick it up. Our time is short before the break here, but Juliet, it's early, but then presidents do things quickly.
Presidents do have the right to do things. What I would say to Julie is that, first of all, you're certainly going to see legal challenges on many of these policies that he's executing, and you could see it in some instances, depending on, for example, if they decide to withhold some public information about emissions from power plants, things like that. There are certain things that legally should be released, and you could see legal challenges and pushback to that. But at the same time, the White House controls its website, and there are certainly ways in which every administration does have the right to control communication. And so that's the push-pull that we're dealing with right now.
The country watching very closely. Julie in Austin, thank you for your call. And Juliet Eilprin with The Washington Post, White House reporter there in the Capitol. Thank you very much for joining us, Juliet.
Thank you, Tom.
Let's turn to regulation or deregulation, President Trump style. Here he was at a meeting with business leaders at the White House on Monday. Broadside criticism of current federal regulation.
We're going to be cutting regulation massively. Now, we're going to have regulation, and it'll be just as strong and just as good and just as protective of the people as the regulation we have right now. The problem with the regulation that we have right now is that you can't do anything. I have people that tell me they have more people working on regulations than they have doing product. And it's out of control. It's gotten out of control.
And how much would President Trump cut federal regulation? Well, here's what he told the business leaders.
We're going to take care of the environment. We're going to take care of safety and all of the other things we have to take care of. But you're going to get such great service. There will be no country that's going to be faster, better, more fair, and at the same time, protecting the people of the country, whether it's safety or so many other reasons where regulations are good. We think we can cut regulations by 75%, maybe more. But by 75%.
75%. That is a big number. That got our attention. We want to spend a little bit of time looking at that. We're going to talk about pipelines, Keystone XL, and Dakota Access later in this hour. But first, with us from Washington, Diane Katz, Senior Research Fellow on Regulatory Policy at the Heritage Foundation, conservative think tank there. Diane, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
And from Philadelphia, Kerry Colonnese, Professor of Law, Political Science, University of Pennsylvania, Director of the Penn Program on Regulation. Kerry, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
Diane, 75% cut in federal regulation. Is he serious? Is that possible? Does he mean that?
Well, I think we all have to start getting used to his exaggerated rhetoric, number one. So 75% of what, I'm not sure. And I wouldn't say that based on any measure that, you know, we'll get there, although there certainly is plenty of room for major reforms throughout the regulatory system, which has just exploded in terms of size and scope.
Kerry, we'll come back after a break and look at this. But what Diane says, and you know, she's pro cutting regulation, but 75% sounds like kind of a number, maybe out of a hat to her, or you know, a Trump style descriptor here. But if we're anywhere near that scale, what does it mean for American? I don't know, for the environment, for worker safety, for transportation safety. Can you do that, as the president says, and still have a safe country?
Well, again, it's not clear 75% of what. First of all, it's not 75% of all regulation in the United States. We have state governments and local governments that regulate.
Hey, stick with federal. That's already pretty big.
Yeah. Right. But even if it's just federal, we don't know if that's 75% of the words, pages, costs, overall impacts. So it's very unclear what that means. If it's 75% of all the rules and words and pages on the books, as Diane said, that's not going to happen. And it would be obviously very detrimental, especially if the reductions, if they're massive and if they occur in an ad hoc way, and they could be very detrimental to the kinds of protections that the public receives from regulation, whether it's in air quality, water quality, safe banks, nuclear reactors that aren't melting down, airplanes that aren't crashing, and so forth. There's lots of public protections.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking this hour about the Donald Trump, President Trump promise to toss out federal regulations on a very large scale. He said reduced by 75%. Take that number as you will. Later in this hour, we're going to look at the new president's moves on the Keystone XL and Dakota Access pipelines. But first, regulation, or Trump-style deregulation, if that's what's coming. Diane Katz is with us from the Heritage Foundation, Senior Research Fellow there in Regulatory Policy. Kerry Colonnese is with us from the Penn Program on Regulation, Director there at the University of Pennsylvania, author of Does Regulation Kill Jobs? You can join us. Are you for it? Just get the federal government out of regulation, out of the world, out of the way? What about the safety of our environment, our transportation, our workplaces, our lives? Who do you trust to assess which regulations are working and which, perhaps, are not? Here he was in that meeting with automobile manufacturers. He brought it up on Monday and again on Tuesday, yesterday, saying he was against unnecessary regulation.
We're bringing manufacturing back to the United States big league. We're reducing taxes very substantially, and we're reducing unnecessary regulations. And we want regulations, but we want real regulations that mean something.
And the new president saying regulation in this country is crazy, out of control.
I have friends that want to build in the United States. They go many, many years, and then they can't get their environmental permit over something that nobody ever heard of before. And it's absolutely crazy. And I am, to a large extent, an environmentalist. I believe in it. But it's out of control.
I'm an environmentalist, but it's out of control. Kerry, the new president has said he's putting a huge emphasis on rebuilding or building American industry, bringing jobs back. And the sort of operating assumption in his comments there is that American regulation, federal regulation, is a big hindrance to industry growing here, the economy growing here. Is that right? I'll put it to you, Diane, as well. But Kerry, first to you.
Well, there's no question that in some individual cases, and maybe even a number of individual cases, there are companies that go out of business or have to lay off workers because of regulation. For example, all the refineries that used lead additives in gasoline before the Reagan administration outlawed those had people working putting in lead additives. Those people aren't needed anymore, and Now, of course, there's great public benefits from getting lead out of gasoline, too. So, yes, there can be some individual cases, but the research is really consistent that there really isn't much of an aggregate impact of regulation on employment levels. When you look across the whole economy and you add up both job losses as well as job gains, so we get lead out of gasoline and we lose some workers in the companies that made lead additives for gasoline, but then we put in place regulations to require catalytic converters as pollution control devices on automobiles, and that helps companies that make those, and they have to hire more workers. And the job losses and the job gains tend to wash out, and there aren't significant effects overall on the economy from regulation.
Diane, how about it from your perspective? Is regulation a major aggregate impediment to jobs in this country, or as Kerry says, well, they move elsewhere, but they're still there?
I think there are tremendous impacts of regulation across both the economy and in terms of consumers, you know, individual lives. One thing that we forget to look at is what jobs are not created, which is different from jobs being killed off. And there is no question that investments that are foregone because regulatory costs, you know, preclude them means there is less innovation, there's less investment, and there's less job creation. Take, for example, you know, the Dodd-Frank law. There's, you know, a number of provisions in there that really restrict people's access to capital and to home building and to, you know, a variety of different banking services. And, you know, you can look across the board at all types of regulations, the Clean Power Plan and what it means for energy costs, or even the energy standards that make appliances more costly, that, you know, that impacts family budgets. So every regulation is a cost. Now, the question is, how does that balance against the benefits we get and whether it's the proper role of government to regulate in that area? You know, for a long time, the Fed's focused on protection of our environment, protection of our health and safety. But in recent years, as we've made progress in all those areas, we're starting to see more regulation of our lifestyle and our lifestyle choices. And those are ones that I think that's where we start to get beyond the pale. As it is, we've seen an increase in annual regulatory costs of about $200 billion a year over the Obama and Bush administration.
May I ask you, Diane, if if you don't have a proper regulation of the banking system, we saw what happened in 2007, 2008. That was very scary. If you don't have environmental protections, clean up the power situation, and we get more climate change, and of course we can have devastating results there. Are you just ignoring the future costs or the cost of another potential banking meltdown without these regulations?
Well, sure, that's a reasonable thing to wonder about. And, you know, there's a couple points to that. One is that it's wrong to assume that the financial crisis occurred because there was no regulation. There was ton of regulation.
Yeah, but it was very, very different profile of banking in this country when that happened from a decade and a half earlier. You know that very well.
Well, and I also know that a lot of the seeds of that financial crisis were in some of that regulation, whereas a lot of Dodd-Frank now doesn't address what were really the problems that created the crisis. It doesn't deal with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, for example. And the biggest part of Dodd-Frank really gives power to the biggest banks in this country, which is contrary to the idea that, you know, we want institutions that are too big to fail. Dodd-Frank is one big gift to the big banks in this country.
Kerry,
just saying smarter regulation doesn't necessarily mean no regulation.
Kerry, what about that?
Better regulation.
Yeah, I hear it. And the president said it himself. He said, and we heard it, and with the tape we played, Kerry, we're going to have regulation. It'll be just as strong, just as good, just as protective as the regulation we have now, just a lot less of it in volume. Is that possible?
No one could disagree with with President Trump that we should be opposed to unnecessary regulations. The crux of it is which regulations are unnecessary. And I know for a fact there are going to be some regulations that could be taken off the books. The Obama administration has had a look-back initiative where they reported about $22 billion of savings from trimming regulations.
But we're talking wholesale here. When you start talking about 75%, can we still have safe banking? Can we still have environmental improvement that deters climate change if you put the knife in that deep, Kerry?
Look, the reason we have regulation fundamentally is because there's some failures that take place. It's very well studied and very well known, failures that take place in the free market system. Free market system does a lot of good, but you need regulation, and there are going to be costs that are imposed upon industry because you're internalizing costs that they would otherwise impose on the public free of charge. So regulation does have some trade-offs associated with it. And as Diane said, yeah, there may be some costs associated with these regulations, and they're not trivial, but they're also offset. And study after study is showing that they're offset in the aggregate by the benefits that they deliver.
I want to bring our listeners in, if I may. Chattanooga, Tennessee, Josh is calling. Hi, Josh, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. First-time caller, long-time listener, and I just love what you do for our country. Thank you. But my question to your panel is when you step back and take a look at some of the things the Trump administration is doing, such as Rex Tillerson at State, Exxon had a deal going on in Russia that's now, you know, is now in question, and pulling back on some sanctions is going to do that. Looking at regulations to protect the environment, the Clean Power Plan is you know, when you factor in the cradle to grave and the impact it has on people's health, I'm just honestly very concerned for my three daughters' future and the health that they'll have. And, you know, I think we need to be educating people on the impact of these environmental decisions.
Hey, listen with me. Listen with us, Josh, to the president. Again, this was on Monday, saying he's saying he cares about the environment.
I'm a very big person when it comes to the environment. I've received awards on the environment, but some of that stuff makes it impossible to get anything built.
Okay, there's an awards claim in there. Washington Post looked at that, and they found one award by the Metropolitan Golf Association in 2007 for a golf course in New Jersey that was later cited for environmental violations. So never mind that. But you hear him, Josh. He says he's big on the environment, but it makes it impossible for things to get built.
Can I
speak to Josh first for a minute, Diane? I've just asked him a question.
Yeah, so, I find that farcical, and it's hard to believe, you know, when you have Scott Pruitt heading the EPA, someone who wanted to shut down the EPA. I just think, you know, climate denial is a real concern in the future. These are not alternative facts. The climate is changing. Carbon is in the atmosphere is increased. Sea level is rising. Ocean acidity. These are facts, right? And you can't brush them under the table and then appoint all oil industry people. And so just on the topic of regulations, I think the things like regulations for the renewable energy standards and for wind and solar discounts and all that stuff, that was moving us forward, and I'm just afraid we're moving backwards.
Josh, stick with us. Diane, what do you want to say to our caller from Chattanooga?
You know, I'm very sympathetic to your concerns about your children's future. I have, you know, the same. But I think it's just as important to take that concern about how we regulate and look at what we are actually doing. The Obama administration itself has acknowledged that the Clean Power Plan will not make any appreciable difference in global warming and or any climate change.
Well, it helped us get an international agreement on global warming. Without it, we might not have had that at all.
The reason they did, they adapted the Clean Power Plan, and they've said this, was to show other countries that we're taking action, not because what we're doing will actually produce meaningful results. And so are there better ways to, you know, get the kinds of environmental protections that we do want, that are more effective, that are more beneficial? And I'd say absolutely.
Do you trust, Kerry, that the Trump administration is going to come up with better ways than the Clean Power Plan to address climate change?
Well, the Clean Power Plan, keep in mind, is under a stay from the Supreme Court, so it's it may well not go anywhere, depending on how things take place with the Supreme Court nomination next week as well. But it's also the case that the opposition to the Clean Power Plan is largely driven by concern, and it's understandable about a shift in the economy in the Appalachian region in particular, and in other parts of the country that are heavily dependent upon coal production. But those industries are really facing a challenge from technology and other businesses in the natural gas industry. So I think the debate over the Clean Power Plan is probably either moot or are going to be behind us. Mm. But the challenges for climate change will be real, and they continue regardless of what happens with the Clean Power Plan. Mm. And yes, it is an open question still what this administration will do on climate change. There are some possibilities that given the number of businessmen and women that are in the cabinet, that they may well recognize that there are real threats to industry and to business from climate change. And there's a real need for improving climate resilience around the country too. And that may be something that through the Trump administration's infrastructure plan, there could be some really important investments that will protect the public well-being. It would be great if we could see that happen under this administration.
Caller Josh in Chattanooga, do you see a better way of regulating or steering away from climate change under the Trump administration?
I do. It's a business model. If you look at solar jobs in the country, they're growing 10 times the rate of your average job growth. Look at wind jobs, the renewable energy sector, and I used to be an Einstein Fellow Department of Energy. It's amazing what's happening in renewable energy. I worked as an educator, and that was my role there as in education. And the one thing I want you to think about are young people want a voice in this, and because, you know, you're 12, 14, 16 years old, you don't Your voice isn't being heard, but they have a stake in this future, and renewable energy is the solution. We need to be the leader of the world and not allow China to take that mantle.
But we're talking about new pipelines. We're going to talk about that in a moment. I mean, more about that than about renewables right now under
that
Trump.
That scares me, Tom. That scares me. That's what scares me.
Josh, we've got it. Josh in Chattanooga. One more here. Belfast, Maine. Ryan is calling. Hi, Ryan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to comment on, it seems like if you look back through history, the people, the proponents of deregulation seem to have been mostly on the wrong side of things when it comes to worker safety, fought tooth and nail. When it came to consumer protection and automobile safety, fought tooth and nail about simple things like seatbelts, that kind of stuff. And now here we are in the banking industry, and it seems like most of the commentary is, oh, well, regulation is bad, but when you look at the periods of time where there's been long and strong regulation, we haven't had banking failures and collapses. We haven't had depressions, you know. And then
Ryan, I hear that, but speak to Donald Trump. Ryan, speak to Donald Trump's concern. He says our economic growth has not been sufficient, and as a result, the country is in trouble. And if he takes away some of this regulation, he says he can crank it up.
I think who he's going to crank it up for are the people that are really successful and don't really need a lot of help. The regulation is going to protect people like me. I'm in the solar field, and I think that some of the tariffs that might come in are going to affect, the ability for people like me to continue to have a paying job that pays the bills and is something that I enjoy doing.
Ryan, I appreciate your call from Maine. Diane Katz, how long does it we lost Diane. Carrie, how long does it take to get this kind of change, big cut in regulation going, if that's what the president intends to do?
Well, if he's expecting to actually roll back regulations that are on the books, there's basically two ways that can happen. One is through legislation that revokes those rules. That has to go through Congress, and that will be subjected to likely filibusters from the Senate Democrats. The other way is to work through his agencies, and you put in place heads of agencies who are sympathetic to your regulatory agenda if you're president, and you try to encourage them to take forward that agenda. That's not going to be easy, because to roll back an existing regulation, the federal regulatory agencies like OSHA and the EPA, they have to go through, again, the whole process that they had to go through in the first place to create that regulation. You can't just take it off the books with a stroke of a pen. There's a full, almost formal process, really, to enact regulations and to revoke them.
We'll see what happens with that. Kerry Colonnese at the Penn Program on Regulation. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Diane Katz, I'm sorry we lost you there just at the end, but we'll talk again. I appreciate your being with us today. Senior Research Fellow in Regulatory Policy at the Heritage Foundation, thank you for joining us. Listeners, in a moment, we will look at President Trump's moves on the Keystone XL and Dakota Access pipelines. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Relationships are important. Cooking together builds strong family bonds, and Blue Apron makes cooking together fun and easy. Research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly three times more often. So join in, get the family together, and choose your meals each week. They come to your door with pre-measured ingredients so you can spend time with your family and not at the grocery store. With the simple instructions, everyone can help prepare the meal. There's no risk. Get your first three meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/onpoint.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Yesterday, as one of his first 10 executive actions, President Trump made good on one of his campaign promises and signed actions that reopened the way for approval of the Keystone XL and Dakota Access oil pipelines. The oil industry and its supporters are cheering the move. Opponents, environmentalists, Native Americans, landowners, many of whom fought to block construction of the pipelines, say they will continue to fight. We're going to look at that in this segment of the show. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. How are you reacting to the news of President Trump's moves on pipelines? Here he was yesterday signing an executive action meant to speed approvals on Keystone XL and Dakota Access pipelines. Here's sound from a video of him signing those actions.
This is with regard to the construction of the Keystone pipeline. Something that's been in dispute, and it's subject to a renegotiation of terms by us. We're going to renegotiate some of the terms, and if they'd like, we'll see if we can get that pipeline built. A lot of jobs, 28,000 jobs. Great construction jobs.
The president yesterday, of course, we have to do the fact check here. The State Department says 16,000 jobs, not 28,000, and says 3,900 construction jobs, not 28,000. But there he was signing. Reaction, pretty swift here. This was Seattle. Demonstrators already out yesterday beating drums, chanting in protest over the move. Join us. Are you amazed? These pipelines are back on the table. Are you cheering? Are you appalled? Will all the protests be back? And what's the impact here? If they're built, if they're not? Joining me now from Los Angeles is Linda Mapes, reporter for the Seattle Times, who spent a lot of time on pipeline issues. Linda Mapes, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
And with us from Washington is Michael Brune, executive director of the Sierra Club, the country's largest grassroots environmentalist organization. Mike Brune, welcome to On Point. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Linda, first to you. Exactly what happened yesterday with the strokes of the pen? What does it mean exactly? Is it a done deal, or it just opens the way, or it speeds it? What happened, Linda?
You know, the important thing to recognize here is what didn't happen. You can't do government by Twitter. There are still three branches of government, and what happened yesterday is yet to be seen.
Yeah, but this wasn't a tweet. He was signing something there. He wasn't just writing a tweet.
Very true. And what he did sign was not a directive and not a fiat. What it was a memorandum to the Corps of Engineers that says you can do one of three things. You can expedite the review that's already underway.
Okay.
You can look at rescinding the order that came out in December under the previous administration calling for the environmental impact review that is now underway. Or you can, just go ahead and issue that easement that's needed for the company to get cracking.
And you're just talking Dakota Access here. Is that right, Linda?
I'm talking Dakota Access. And, you know, the thing about what happened yesterday is, you know, it means nothing and everything. I mean, the Corps of Engineers can carry on just as they were with their review, or they can go ahead and issue the easement that's needed to finish the very last bit of that pipeline. It's completely built except for the last 1,000 feet drilling under the river. And there are crews standing by in hotel rooms to get going as soon as they get a green light,
so
if they get it.
With this presidential move, how soon could that green light hypothetically come?
Golly, I mean, it could come today if they want to. And at that point, what would happen next, of course, is the Standing Rock Sioux tribe is also standing by with its lawsuit to block construction. And, you know, then it would be up to the courts. Would they intervene quickly? Would they intervene too slowly for it to effectively matter on the ground? This job takes about 2 weeks to complete if you work 24-hour shifts. But let's remember this. Even if the pipeline is completed, a court can still intervene to stop the flow of oil. So even if the pipeline is completed, the battle still isn't over.
1,000 feet to complete, that's not much. We'll come back and look at the Dakota Access Pipeline. Michael Bruhn, help us think about the Keystone XL Pipeline. There was also enormous pushback on this, and of course push for it as well. It was put off the table by the Obama administration. What exactly happened in relation to the Keystone XL pipeline yesterday under the pen of Donald Trump, Michael Bruhn?
Okay, so again, the Keystone XL pipeline, for those who need a refresher, this is a pipeline that would take oil, some of the dirtiest oil on the planet, from the tar sands in Canada all the way down into the U.S., basically transporting it all the way through our country down to the Gulf, where much of it would be exported. This is oil that is very toxic, very flammable, very carbon intensive. So it's a potent accelerant in terms of making climate change much worse. The status of Keystone is much different from Dakota Access in that this 1,000-mile segment hasn't been built, hasn't been approved. There's none of it has been built except for a southern portion that was approved several years ago. But this 1,000-mile segment doesn't exist, and in fact, when it goes through Nebraska, there's not even any proposed route right now. So there's not that much that the president can do in the very short term to approve this, to make this pipeline a reality. But there is what his action yesterday indicated, a willingness to put this back on the table, to get into conflict with a lot of ranchers and farmers who don't want a pipeline going through their property. And, of course, putting him in and his administration in conflict with climate science, because we can't take dirty oil out of the ground and burn it at the rates that we've been doing.
I've got that as your view there at the Sierra Club. I absolutely have that. And, of course, there's a lot of consensus about climate change concern here. But strictly in government power terms, I don't want to obfuscate. I mean, if the president says it's back on the table, is it back on the table?
The president has ultimate authority on whether or not this pipeline can be approved.
And that's what yesterday he has revived.
He has, yes. So to get very specific, he has indicated a willingness to have this pipeline be built. That is different from approving a pipeline,
right?
Which has not happened yet because there's no proposal, there's no specific route that has been outlined that would allow the president to approve it.
Yeah, but of course, the first thing is just the sign-off, and then it could have lots of bumps in the road, but that sign-off is what they didn't get before, and he's saying now, well, let's reconsider that, and indicating, he said on the campaign trail, he wants it.
This is true.
And here we are. Linda Mapes, can you picture, a couple of years from now, by the end of a four-year term, that both of these pipelines would be underway or up and running?
You know, I think you raise a good question, because remember, these projects happen in a market. They don't happen in a bubble or some kind of dreamland. And there's another pipeline we need to talk about. That's the Trans Mountain, just approved by the Canadian Labour government. That's a gigantic pipeline, again, tar sands oil, all the way from Alberta to the Pacific and into Metro Vancouver. And, you know, do we really need all these pipelines? Would oil prices today even support these activities? You begin to ask yourself if the market would even support this, let alone the people of the United States and in the communities and among the First Nations and tribes that would, no doubt rise up against this. I mean, the First Nations in BC have already said, sure, you've approved it, but you're never going to build it. And they're already organizing mass civil disobedience. So it's, I think there's a real market question here. There's a price question. There's a glut question. And there's a very real question about opposition to this on the ground. It's going to be very serious. I mean, honestly, I'm quite worried about what will happen in North Dakota if the drill bit starts to turn.
But let me ask you about that Trans Mountain pipeline, because that's interesting here. Is that what Canada turned to after the Keystone XL was blocked, so that they'd take the tar sands oil and instead of sending it down through the United States, they'd send it over the Rockies and send it, what, off toward China?
Yeah, off toward China. And interestingly, I'm in Los Angeles because they also send it to California in communities down here in Los Angeles who are trying to revive their river and trying to bring back some of these communities that have already been hammered by industrialization and pollution. They don't want it. They don't want an even deeper commitment to fossil fuels, even more oil, you know, being moved through their communities. And so that Canadian pipeline is directly connected to the communities down here in Los Angeles. So from First Nations communities in BC to Washington State tribes and communities in the San Juan Islands who are very concerned about 7 times increase in the oil tanker traffic through the Salish Sea, all the way down here to Metro Los Angeles, there's a lot of opposition to that pipeline.
Of course, there's a big push for these pipelines, too. Canada wants to see the Keystone XL. Oil companies want the Dakota Access Pipeline. Here's an interview with the Prairie Public Broadcasting yesterday. Ron Ness with North Dakota Petroleum Council said that pipeline construction, he said, is long overdue.
This pipeline should be moving oil today, and we'd have 2,000 or 3,000 less trucks on the road in western North Dakota. We'd be getting our oil to market to a better market more safely and more reliably, and we'd be getting a better price for it.
But there are definitely protesters standing by, ready to try and stop it. Talking with Amy Sisk of Prairie Public Broadcasting again yesterday, Gina Neal, she's still at that campsite around the Dakota Access Pipeline, said she knew that President Trump would try to push the pipeline forward.
To me, it's not surprising. We kind of knew that was going to happen. To me, this is just such a serious issue that I'm not packing up to go home. I'm going to stay.
She's going to stay. It will be very interesting to see what happens on that site if the bulldozers fire up again. Heidi in Goldsboro, North Carolina. Heidi, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a 2-year-old son, and I am absolutely, these last few days have just been horrifying because we know climate change is real. That's not even a question. And I would like to know, with these pipelines, how is the Trump administration going to answer to my generation as a millennial and for my son? Because we are the ones that have to live through this. We're the ones who have to live through the aftermath. So how are they going to answer for this?
Heidi, I will pick that question up, I promise you. Let me get one more call here, and then we'll do it. Bill in Frederick, Maryland. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm learning a lot today. I'm listening to both sides, and that's why I called in. I listened to an educator in the last segment say that he was scared of the pipeline, and he works with 12- and 14-year-olds. And what concerns me is he scaring these kids in the classroom, or is he doing like you're doing and letting both sides give information and then let people decide? That's where I'm coming from.
Well, I mean, I hear you, Bill. On the other hand, that caller from Chattanooga was an Einstein fellow in the energy department. He knows something about energy. So if he's scared by it, shouldn't he be articulating that? I mean, kids don't know, but adults are supposed to look around responsibly and figure it out, aren't they?
Okay. Well, as an educator, you really have to let the kids decide. There's going to be students who, even after listening to your show, some of the pros as opposed to the cons, students will ask questions, and first, I don't think a teacher wants to try to convince.
Well, I hear you on raising inquisitive minds. At the same time, we have adult responsibilities in this world. Michael Bruin at the Sierra Club, you hear Heidi wondering about the future of her generation and her 2-year-old child. And then, you know, our caller Bill says, well, hold your horses. Let the kids decide.
Okay, I'd like to speak to both points. First, Heidi, I thank you for calling in. I have, I'm a father of young children myself, and I worry as leader of the Sierra Club and as a dad, I worry about the future that our kids are growing up into. And the actions taken by this administration in just the last 5 days are deeply frightening. Here's the good news. The good news is that clean energy, the solutions to climate change, are now more affordable and more accessible than fossil fuels. What that means is that solar and wind and energy storage and electric vehicles are now cheaper than coal and oil and natural gas in a majority of states in the U.S. and in a majority of countries around the world. So this is even more, we don't have a technological problem. We don't even have an economic problem anymore. It's mostly a political problem. So I wanted to get to what Bill said, because the main controversy here really is about jobs and the environment. And you heard in the clip by Donald Trump, President Trump, by talking about how this will create X number of jobs. He exaggerated the figure. What I think environmentalists have to recognize is that this pipeline would create jobs. And for those families who would get those jobs, that's pretty important. It helps pay the rent, helps pay the mortgage, maybe it helps put a kid through college. Those jobs are going to be important. Even if they're temporary, a good 6 months job putting down a pipeline can be a good job. But what our opponents have to recognize is that there are jobs associated with any kind of clean energy development. If we're installing wind farms, that's a good job. If we're installing solar or investing in energy storage, those are also good jobs. And the fact is that per unit of energy, there are more jobs in clean energy than in fossil fuels. So when we talk about doubling down on clean energy and fighting climate change, we're talking about it as a jobs program. We can create jobs, cut pollution, and revive our economy all at the same time. So fighting climate change isn't just this obligation that we have. It's an opportunity that we have.
Michael, I get that. I get that, and I hear it. But I want to be very clear-sighted about what's happening now. President Trump is moving on this front, and there are immediate interests, and he might say immediate needs here, that, you know, I appreciate the picture you're painting for Heidi, but on the other hand, is it not now a real possibility that within a few years, both of these pipelines will be flowing with oil?
Of course it's a real possibility. That's why we're having this call, and that's why we need to fight these proposals. As Linda was talking about, there are many opportunities to fight these proposals, whether it's in the marketplace, whether it's in the occupations that have inspired millions of Americans at Dakota Access, or at Standing Rock, rather, or where it's where the oil would go. There are lots of communities who are saying, we don't want this oil to come to refineries in our communities.
Yep.
And reducing the overall demand for fossil fuels. One thing that hasn't been mentioned on this call is the other thing that Trump is planning on doing in the next couple months is reversing the progress that's been made in the last 8 years to make our cars and trucks and SUVs more efficient. We've made great progress to accelerate the development of hybrids and electric vehicles, and in cutting U.S. consumption of oil by millions of barrels of oil a day. Trump is planning on reversing that.
Michael Brune,
fight that as well.
Executive Director at the Sierra Club. Michael, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Linda, you know the Dakota scene well. If there's a different attitude, if there's a green light, there's only 1,000 feet to go to complete that, can the protesters stop it again?
You know, I can be sure of this. They will certainly try. And this is, at this point, a very militarized construction site. There are at least 3 levels of security between where the protesters are encamped a couple miles away and where the drill pad is. We're talking about razor wire. We're talking about, last time around, an 8-state police force marshaled in order to protect the construction of this private oil development project.
We've got the picture, and we're out of time right there. It's going to be something. Linda Mapes at the Seattle Times, thank you very much for being with us, Linda.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.